Thank you very much, Joyce. Our next speaker, as I mentioned earlier, is Don B. Cates, Jr. Don received his JD from Yale University Law School. He's taught law at Stanford University, St. Louis University, and the University of Melbourne. He previously worked for the late civil rights lawyer William Kunstler, whose some fame is, I guess the most famous thing was his involvement, actually membership in the Chicago Seven. Don has also worked with the California Rural Legal Assistance, where he served as Director of Legal Research and Senior Litigation Attorney. In addition, he's been trustee for the Poverty Lawyers for Effective Advocacy, member of the California State Advisory Committee to the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, Director of Litigation and Deputy Director of the San Mateo Legal Aid Society, and the list just goes on and on. His books include Restricting Handguns, The Liberal Skeptics Speak Out, Firearms and Violence, Issues of Public Policy, which is a book that Don edited, and I worked with him, and it was a real delight to be involved in that project. His most recent book is The Great American Gun Debate, Essays on Firearms and Violence with Gary Kleck. I'm very pleased to introduce Don Cates.
Well, on the subject of England and gun control, let me start out by talking a little bit about Bosnia. When Yugoslavia broke up, the army had been controlled by the Serbs. The Serbs ended up with the army. The Bosnians, who were Muslims, ended up with nothing. When the Serbs decided to make war on the Bosnians, England declared pursuant to its arms control policies, declared a complete embargo on providing any arms. That was certainly useful to the Serbs. They had an army. The result with the Bosnians was 200,000 civilians murdered because they didn't have arms. Eventually, the odd combination of the United States, even Bill Clinton, Israel, and various Muslim countries armed the Bosnians, and they were able to bring the genocide, or religicide as you will, to a close. To the very end, England maintained its position of being opposed to arms, and of course was also unwilling to do anything to help the Muslims outside of giving them arms. One of the things that we found in the civil rights movement was that when the whites had all the arms, they used them. But when we had arms, and we used the arms, the result would be government intervention. As long as we were going to be killed, nobody cared. But if there was going to be a war, it suddenly became clear to the powers that be that we needed to have enforcement to stop both sides from killing each other. Now let me move to East Timor, a subject of that's been much in the news lately, although the facts I'm giving you, or many of them, have not been reported, at least not in this context. East Timor is an obscure island in what used to be called the East Indies. It was owned by Portugal for hundreds of years, until 1975, when Portugal gave up its empire. There were independence forces in East Timor, which was one of the reasons the Portuguese left. I mean, they had many other reasons for leaving. Basically, they decided that being an empire wasn't very useful anymore after having fought for 10 or 12 years or so in Angola, a very brutal guerrilla war. So the Portuguese moved out. Before East Timor could do anything, the Indonesian military moved in. and Indonesia has ruled them ever since. There has been continuing, ongoing strife and tumult, which eventually induced the UN to hold a referendum in East Timor about independence. The result of that referendum was an overwhelming vote in favor of independence, a vote of approximately 80% to 20%. The result of that was that thousands of people who were in favor of independence in East Timor have subsequently been murdered. Now, on the face of it, it's hard to understand how that can happen. How can somebody who represents 20% of the population get in a war with somebody who represents 80% of the population and win and have virtually no casualties? Well, the answer is easy. Gun control. Legally, only the Indonesian police and military can have guns. However, the Indonesian police and military have had no difficulty, had no compunction about providing those guns to their allies, the 20% of the people of East Timor who are opposed to independence, recognizing that they've got the guns, they've got the power, and nobody's going to punish them. They go around killing people by the thousands. This is nothing new. It's nothing new in world history, and it's certainly nothing new to Indonesia. In 1965, 66, and 67, Indonesia had a problem, or perceived itself as having a problem. The problem was expressed as dangerous leftists, but that's not the whole extent of the problem, which I'll get to in a moment. In any event, to deal with the problem of dangerous leftists, the Indonesian military and police gave right-wing groups large amounts of arms. In the ensuing massacre, approximately 1 million Indonesians were killed. Many of them were, in fact, leftists and communists. However, a very large minority of them were Chinese, not because they had any particular political stripe, but because the Chinese are the Jews of the Orient. They're very smart, they're very competent, they work hard, and wherever they go, they're very successful. And wherever they go, people don't like that. As a result, somewhere between 300,000 and 400,000 Chinese were murdered regardless of their political stripe. So politicide turned into genocide, or was accompanied by genocide. This, of course, is nothing new. In our century, over 150 million people, unarmed people, have been killed by governments, not in wars. I mean, massacre of the Jews in Europe occurred during a war, but it had nothing to do with the war. In fact, the war, to some extent, actually hampered it. Hitler would have carried this out regardless. Now, one of the reasons for the Second Amendment is that genocide and politicide are not limited to this century. They were well known as phenomena to the Founding Fathers. The Founding Fathers knew, they were classically educated, they read their Thucydides, they knew that in 416 BC, the Athenians went to the island of Melos and killed or enslaved the entire population because the island of Melos had declared themselves on behalf of the Spartans in the Peloponnesian War. Thucydides was a cashiered Athenian general who wrote the first great work of history, as opposed to Herodotus, who wrote the first great work of historical fiction. a very entertaining work, and far more pleasant to read than Thucydides. But Thucydides gave an explanation of what happened in Melos, an explanation which describes an eternal truth known to the Founding Fathers. The strong do what they will. The weak endure what they must. It was the Founding Fathers' belief that the people should never be weak and the government should never be stronger than they. The Founding Fathers would be utterly appalled at the notion that the police and the military should have guns. And if the citizenry have guns, those guns should be less powerful than those of the police. The Founding Fathers, who were authentic liberals, would be astounded that people who call themselves liberals today think the military and the police should determine who has guns. The military and the police, and of course whoever they wish to arm. Now, Joyce spoke about the tragic massacres that have occurred recently. In fact, they represent a tiny minority of our homicide situation in the United States. The great majority of homicide victims are very much like their killers, which is to say they are people with long records of crime. Obviously, that doesn't apply to the innocent children who have been killed in Littleton and all kinds of other shootings. But it's useful to talk about what you would do if you were seriously concerned with that kind of massacre as a public policy problem. It's not a serious public policy problem in the United States. It represents 1/10 of 1/100 of 1% of our homicide problem. It is a serious problem in Israel. In Israel, guns are far more available to the population than they are in the United States. if you want to own a gun, at least if you're a Jew, Arabs might be a different story entirely, but if you want to own a gun in Israel, you go to the authorities and you get a license. It is easily available to anyone who has training, and all Jews, male and female, have military training, except for a few religious fanatic nuts on the right who are unwilling to have, who don't support the nation of Israel and consider it better that they be martyred by than that they live. But in any event, any Jew who wants a license can have one, and a license is not just a license to own, it's a license to carry a gun wherever you go. It is the policy of the State of Israel that there will be armed people everywhere, in all public places. We all, I assume, remember the tragedy in McDonald's in San Ysidro, where a nut managed to shoot down 31 people, killing 22 of them, most of them children. About 4 weeks before that, four Arab terrorists armed with submachine guns attacked a crowd spot in Jerusalem. They managed to kill one person before they were shot down by armed Israeli civilians. The next day, the surviving terrorist was presented to the press, and he was quite bitter. Nobody told his people that these Israelis had guns. What they intended to do is a lesson that we have to learn. They intended to go from crowd spot to crowd spot, killing people and then escaping before the police could get there. The police can't get there and protect you. A large part of our massacre problem, to the extent we have one, involves reliance on the police about police training. And we always hear, we need people who have discipline, who have training, this and that and so on. Well, let's talk about the San Ysidro Massacre. The San Ysidro Massacre took 77 minutes. Not because the police weren't there. The SWAT team got there within 8 minutes. But they were ordered not to fire until their commanding officer arrived. And he was in a traffic jam on the Harbor Freeway. Okay? This guy went around shooting children on a floor. Okay? Went around shooting children for 77 minutes. Now, if anybody in here who isn't a cop had been there, they'd have shot the son of a bitch. But the cops waited until they had their orders. Yes, sir. Okay, that's not San Ysidro. That's Luby's Cafeteria in Texas. The woman involved is a woman named Susanna Huff, who is now a Texas legislator, and she is, incidentally, a leading advocate of the NRA. another example, which, again, I'm not putting down the police. There are lots of reasons why I, as a liberal, do put down the police, but I don't put them down for these things. I simply point out the limitations. Why did all those people die in 101 California? They died because the killer was coming down the stairs. The police were coming up, and he shot himself to death. The police had no idea what had gone on. All they knew was that they were shooting. Their protocol was they go through the building room by room, clearing it. And they didn't go through until they had cleared the staircase. As a result, all those people died, or almost everyone who died because they bled out. If someone had rushed into that building and given them first aid, they would have all lived. But the police had discipline, and they had a protocol. And the result of that was that all these people died. That's not to say that discipline and protocol and planning are bad things. It's only to say that there are downsides as well as upsides. All right, I think I've probably taken more time than I should have, but let me just end with a final point, which is that the notion that crime can be defeated by depriving its victims of all the means of self-defense is a form of idiocy which George Orwell described well when he made the remark, "Only an intellectual could believe something as stupid as that."